Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm your host today, Phil Huff, and we have a pretty exciting show with us. We're always grateful to welcome people who are new to the community, especially in important roles in community organizations. And today we have with us Chris Bilbrey, the new director for the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center, also known as IPAC. Good morning and welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and where you came from, how you got interested in this kind of work, and what brought you to Sandpoint. So there's a mouthful.
Yeah, thank you. So most recently, my family and I moved here from Durango, Colorado, for this position with IPAC. I started my journey in the snow and avalanche profession in 2002 as a ski patroller in Southern Colorado. I attended Fort Lewis College, which is a small liberal arts school in Durango, Colorado, for my undergraduate degree, and fell in love with backcountry skiing and all things mountains and snow related. And then started ski patrolling for the next 11 years and really became passionate about it. Worked on an active avalanche mitigation program for Wolf Creek ski area. And then, like, you know, most people in our profession that just had an itch to know more, I thought grad school was the next good professional route. And I studied at Montana State University in Bozeman, sort of with a hybrid of snow and avalanche mechanics, and then ended up in environmental sciences, where sort of took my knowledge of snowpack and snow structure and merged it with some remote sensing and dust on snow work, and just put together some really cool research, not avalanche related, but important in the whole bigger snow and water impacts to the Western U.S. And then after grad school, or right about the tail end of grad school, I started getting involved in public avalanche forecasting. I worked for the Flathead Avalanche Center over in Montana for a season. And then the past 6 years, I've been working for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center as one of the forecasters in the San Juan Mountains. Kind of in and all of that, in intermixed with all of that, I also worked as the education coordinator for the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center in Bozeman, running their outreach program for their forest-based center there.
Well, that's a lot of vast background, and it seems like you've been to some very interesting places in the West. How did Sandpoint come on your radar?
You know, that's a really good question. Just was always sort of, you know, looking for that next really interesting professional opportunity, kind of at a point in my career where I was just looking for something new, a little bit of change, although I was enjoying working with the CEIC and worked in a fantastic place that is sort of one of the centers of the avalanche universe in the Western U.S. But what I found out was interesting about IPAC was it's a program that's been around for a really long time. It's in a unique spot regionally, and offers some interesting snow climate aspects. A lot of interesting user groups, different user groups than what I'm accustomed to with in Colorado, meaning, you know, heavily motorized here compared to human powered usage, but also was really a program that looked like it had a really solid foundation. A lot of people that were passionate about working for them, but really was yearning for growth. And so this opportunity came across to just help grow a program, build a sustainable forecasting program here in an area that, as you're well aware of, has experienced somewhat consistent avalanche accidents and fatalities over the last 10 years. And as most things COVID related, backcountry use has increased as more people have moved to the area. And so just a really interesting opportunity for me professionally to engage in a different spot, different snow climate, with new challenges, and help grow a program. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's go right to the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center and where it fits into this whole universe. Tell us about the center and what all it does, its history and mission.
Yeah, so believe it or not, IPAC started in the mid 80s. Two Forest Service based hydrologists, Al Isaacson and Bob Bones Cawson, started alerting the public about periods of high avalanche danger through news releases. For the better part of the late 80s, most of the 90s and early 2000s, IPAC continued to grow, continued to expand at places that they provided information for, but really stayed sort of in this kind of part-time involvement, part-time contribution, 1 or 2 day a week forecasting operation. And that was really all that there was funding and support to sustain. Jumping forward to the early 2000s and mid 2000s, like, an avalanche running down a mountain, the program continued to snowball, growing support, more interest, more users in the backcountry. The Friends of the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center, which is our nonprofit arm, was founded in 2012, really by need of just bigger picture support to the center. And through that, they started incorporating more help, more forecasters, integrating forecasting on other national forests that actually are in Montana in with IPAC, and just kind of got to a big growth point, but just didn't really have the funding support from the forest for a long time, and the Friends just didn't have the capital to really take it to the next step. But like, anybody in our industry says, if you have fatalities, it warrants an avalanche center. And I just think the continued occurrence of fatalities, there was just more motivation in the community with the Friends and then with the forest to push for a full-time director position. And so that's where we're at. And I was lucky enough to convince people that I was had the right vision moving forward for the program, and I'm excited to be the first full-time director, which will bring hopefully a lot of reinforcement to a forecasting program that's been around for the greater part of 30 years, and is and has a really solid foundation.
So I think one of the things that a lot of people are, if not surprised to find out, at least give pause. The IPAC is housed, for lack of a better word, under the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service. Is that true of most of the avalanche centers around the West?
Yeah, so there's 14 avalanche centers throughout the U.S. that are Forest Service affiliated, IPAC being one. I don't know the exact number, but there's a group of centers that are run through nonprofit organizations that are kind of independent from Forest Service oversight. And then you have the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, where I worked in Colorado, which is a state-run organization. It's the only avalanche program in the country that's state-run. But yes, IPAC is an affiliate of the U.S. Forest Service.
How did the Forest Service, rather than say the National Ocean and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, the weather people, how did the Forest Service come to take domain over this?
Well, believe it or not, the Forest Service has worked on snow and avalanche issues in the backcountry on forest system land since at least the 1950s. A lot of the funding initially came about by way of the state of Colorado through what's known as the San Juan Project, where they were really trying to evaluate the impacts of transportation and highway corridors through the mountains of Colorado. And then over time, as that funding ran out and things transitioned more to the state level, the Forest Service took on this more regional capacity. And there's a part of our part of the forest government is the National Avalanche Center, and they developed the avalanche education and information program, which their main objective is to address public safety in the backcountry on forest land through timely, relevant avalanche information, education, and helping people make informed decisions about avalanche conditions in the backcountry. And so really, the root of avalanche forecasting programs is very deep rooted with the forest in one way or another.
Yeah, it makes to me it makes sense from the standpoint that so much of our backcountry recreation, whether it's the backcountry skiers on public lands, which are mostly then mountainous and then mostly Forest Service, say, versus the BLM, which is more rangelandish, to even some of our iconic ski area destinations are here. We have Schweitzer that's on private property, but most of the major ski areas in the West are leases from the Forest Service. So there's some natural inclination towards a partnership with the agency to protect the recreation asset. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, for sure. And another unique thing about avalanche centers and the areas that they forecast for geographically is our boundaries aren't necessarily dictated by state lines or forest lines. I mean, we look at it from the question of avalanche conditions, snowpack conditions, for mountain regions, because we've learned that spatial variability is really important in the snowpack structure over time and throughout the winter. But we try to lump our information sharing specific to mountain regions where we're really taking a complex subject matter and trying to simplify it for public who may not have the knowledge or skill set, as a professional will, because it's even challenging for some of us who've been doing it for a long time to relate it in simple terms.
So, the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center, what's the geography that this center covers?
Yeah, so we provide avalanche forecasts for four different mountain regions. We lump the Selkirks and the West Cabinet Mountains into one area. Another zone that we forecast for are the Purcell Mountains, so north of Libby and Troy, all the way up to the Canadian border. Our third area is the East Cabinet Mountains. And then we have a polygon that we focus on along I-90, Silver Valley, Lookout Pass, vicinity.
So it's a pretty large region.
It is. It's large. There's qu enough geographic separation to where it would not be uncommon for conditions to be different in all four zones. But from what folks have told me, it's also not uncommon that conditions can be pretty similar across the region. There's a lot of things that factor into why and how we break up certain forecast areas and whatnot. But, having the individual polygons, it gives us, from a forecasting standpoint, the ability to either say why everything's similar or highlight why things are quite different
So
for various reasons.
it really covers more than Idaho. We've heard there very clearly some parts of northwest Montana, and I'm going to assume the Selkirks even edge into that eastern sliver of Washington state.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a technical standpoint, I'm not sure our west boundary, I don't think it actually bleeds that far, but I would suspect that there's a lot of times where the portions of the Selkirks that are over in Washington could be quite similar to conditions that are within our, circle on a map, as you want to say.
You probably coordinate closely with your colleagues up in Canada. The Selkirks extend on up in there, as do the Purcells, into some really prime backcountry area. I'm thinking up around Crow's Nest Pass.
Yeah, we definitely have. I wouldn't say necessarily daily communications with Avalanche Canada and their field techs and forecast staff, but yeah, we have good working relationships across the boundary. And I was actually reaching out to one of their data modelers this fall because they do some snowpack modeling that actually extends down into IPAC's forecast area. So just another tool in the toolbox to use to help us have a picture of snow conditions in areas where we don't travel in very frequently, if at all, during the winter.
And you mentioned somewhat intuitively, people who are in the backcountry are going to be the ones most interested in this. And you've mentioned motorized recreation, and we've touched a little bit on backcountry skiers. Who really are your primary audience or clients? Who takes this in?
I mean, it really can be anyone. I mean, I sort of live by the notion that if you live near snow-covered mountains, you should probably know something about avalanches and pay attention to conditions in the winter. A lot of times in, forecasted La Niña winters or winters that are supposed to be snowier or colder than normal, conditions can and do extend below common elevation bands where we see avalanches. So even though you may not be a backcountry recreator, it's not too far-fetched to think that on a big, snow year, we could potentially see avalanche conditions pop up in places that aren't uncommon, and catch people off guard.
Sense. Speaking of La Nina, what are the long range prognostications for this winter? Wet winter, mild winter, both?
I can tell you that most forecasters try not to get too much in the weeds on
Yeah.
long-term winter predictions. Everything I'm seeing historically points to a cold, wet winter, although this will be my first in the panhandle, so it's all going to feel new to me. But really, it all depends on the frequency of storms and the duration in between. I've always said that you could have 6 to 8 inches every week for 6 months, and you probably wouldn't have much of an avalanche problem because the snowpack doesn't sit around and is exposed to environmental conditions that promote change. When we have these long periods between storms, the snowpack is, it's like a storybook. Throughout the winter, it evolves over time. Each day or each weather period is a chapter before the next. And so the longer the snowpack sits under, dry, cool, warm weather, whatever it may be, it's always evolving and changing. And then we get these big storms that overload it, shock load the system, and that's when things fall apart. So big winter, little winter, average winter, there's always going to be moments in time where we're going to have heightened avalanche conditions, and there's going to be other parts of time where you couldn't buy an avalanche if you tried. So
Yeah.
they're all kind of unique in their own way, the way they shape up and take form.
You will, and you, I'm sure you will see this, and if you haven't read into the historical data, but we live in an area, I've been here about 25 winters now, where a degree or two difference can make all the difference. We live right on that precipice of freeze thaw at times, especially down low. And so just 1 or 2 degrees difference can make a big change, highly variable. So probably makes a challenge for the work you do. I'd love to hear more about how you go about putting a forecast together. Is it mostly from weather satellite data on the ground, field collection, boots on the ground, weather stations on the ground? How do you actually make some sense of what's happening and turn it into a prediction?
Yeah, so it, a lot of tools in the toolbox, a holistic approach at deciding for what the danger and what the problems are. But yeah, I mean, a lot of different resolutions of data from telemetry, wind, snowfall data that we can get from, remote weather stations, the Snowtell network. Public observations, what people see. Public observations are a huge part of it too. But yeah, I mean, our field snowpack days, stability tests, tracking layers, tracking change over time. I mean, how do things change? How similar does this snow pit look to the snow pit we dug yesterday, to the snow pit we might dig 2 days from now? But it's really the combination of factoring, weighing all the different pieces of information. Do we see avalanches? How big are those avalanches? When was the last time we saw an avalanche? Are they coming in clumps? Are they on every slope? I mean, there's just a ton of information we weigh in, but really it's also a lot of discussion amongst our forecast team and, talking about the differences we're seeing and factoring in various physical processes that we know that drive change in the snowpack. And so it's really a big team effort. I mean, it's too tall of a task for one person to try to do all by themselves. And at the end of the day, I mean, we make assumptions and there's uncertainty in the forecast. Like we were mentioning earlier, the snowpack is variable over space and time, and we only have snapshots in one piece of a big, larger country. So we do have to make assumptions and use technology like snowpack modeling to help fill in the gaps. But at the end of the day, we use a conceptual model workflow matrix that even though each forecaster might use different weather sites or might start to finish go through the process a little bit differently, we're using the same workflow and process to think about what the problem is, what's its distribution throughout the mountains, how reactive is it to either a natural or human trigger. And then that kind of pegs us at a likelihood, and then we can sort of use the intricacies of the North American Avalanche Danger Scale and try to land in a box. It's like some days it's trying to put a square peg in a round hole, and you just kind of are tasked with making a tough decision some days. And, we're going to get it right a lot of times, but there will be times where we miss it. And that's the nature of the industry.
I think there's this romantic notion, at least I have in my head, of you or one of your colleagues waking up at 12:30 a.m., skinning up and skiing up one of the local mountains, digging a pit, testing it, and coming back down by dawn to put out a report. How much of that actually goes on?
I would say that the touring up in the dark is usually if you're walking around on skis in the dark, you're either you got lost in the backcountry on your field day or you're involved in some sort of search and rescue effort. We do wake, we do start our forecast shifts in the 3, 4 o'clock hour. It really depends on the day and what's going on. But we really rely on the previous day's field data, observations, communication to really set us up for the next day. And then it's incorporating, the latest, weather information we get. We do have good, relationships and communication with both the National Weather Service offices in Missoula and Spokane, and they're a huge crutch to lean on to in terms of the weather and validating model outputs that we're looking at that can really dictate how the avalanche danger might change during a storm on any given point.
When does the season begin, or has it begun already? I mean, it seems like there need to be snow on the ground, but it's not far away that we'll have snow on the ground.
Yeah, for sure. So our winter operations for IPAC start November 1st. And our winter operational season runs through the end of April. In November, we'll issue a general fall statement by November 1st on the website for just, good travel advice, good things to pay attention for. Maybe we have enough snow to where we're actually talking about things to watch out for and manage and train to avoid. And then through most of November, it'll just be kind of periodic updates as needed. Still around here, access into a lot of the terrain where snow is difficult. So there's not a ton of people out, but we do have hunters, and so if we feel the need in November to issue general messages, we will. But by early December, we're hopeful we're in regular forecast operations, and we'll run in that program hopefully through middle of April this year. And try to provide backcountry products till the end of the ski area operating seasons for our local places.
Yeah. So you mentioned the website. How do you disseminate the information? How do you get the information out?
Yeah, so IdahoPanhandleAvalanche.org is our website. You can go there, and there's multiple ways to get the forecast on the homepage. We have a map. You can click on any of the polygons, and it'll take you right to the forecast. There's drop-down menus, quick click boxes, and then I'll take you directly to the avalanche forecast. Our products are structured and tiered for various user groups, and so the deeper you dive through the forecast product, the more advanced it gets in terms of the information it's conveying. And so, typically our homepage is where a lot of our novice beginner users go. They see what the danger rating is, and that's all they can digest. But as you start to dive deeper, the information becomes just a little more complex, a little more in depth, robust. And yeah, people can go there for it. A couple of big changes from on the website and our forecasting operation is we did a little adjustment to our forecast boundaries for this year. So it might be good for folks to go to the website before it starts snowing, familiarize themselves with, some of the different naming, conventional naming we have for some of the zones and kind of how some of the zones are linked. We tried to clean up some old boundary lines that were there for various reasons, and we wanted to just clean that part of it up. But we're also excited that I think we're going to be able to expand our forecast days from two, like they were doing last year, to 5 days a week this year. So
Nice.
we'll be issuing regular avalanche forecasts on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and then again on Wednesday. Tuesday and Thursday are kind of we're still deciding how we're going to manage that. Obviously, if we feel that conditions are going to change significantly on either of those days, or we expect an avalanche warning or an avalanche watch needing to be issued, we've sort of reserved the ability within our weekly structure to
Special meeting.
address that.
Yeah. So, what's the website address?
IdahoPanhandleAvalanche.org.
IdahoPanhandleAvalanche.org. In addition to folks going to the website, is there an attempt to put information to, is there an email subscription or a Facebook group or some other means of people signing up for something?
Yeah, so yeah, there's a couple avenues for that. If you want to donate to the bigger IPAC cause and our friends group, you can go to the website and become a member of the Friends of the Idaho Panhandle. We also the Friends of IPAC actually own the website. Those of us on the forecast staff, we manage the technical information on the website, but our friends group owns the website. They also have a Facebook and an Instagram page, and we try to keep regular communication through the fall and winter through those avenues. And then we're also excited this year to hopefully get a couple radio stations on board to air our for a forecast recording on days that we issue forecasts for, to try to just expand our outreach to people that might not know to go to our website and get that.
I have been approved to say KRFY will be proud to join in that effort. We're working through the details now. So for regular listeners, stay tuned and we'll have more information on that as the season progresses. But KRFY will be hosting the avalanche forecasts from IPAC on a regular basis this winter.
That's fantastic. And it's a great tool to just reach a broader audience. It's been effective at several of the avalanche centers I've worked with over the years.
There any tie-in with the sheriff's Nixley accounts? I'm assuming you're familiar with the emergency alert system, the Nixle, and they put out text messages, emails when there's a missing person, an accident on the Long Bridge, a severe weather event. I'm trying to recall if I've ever seen anything avalanche related, and they tend to be travel oriented, and the threats to our highway systems don't seem as severe here as in some states, but To your knowledge, has there been, or is there a way or reason to tie into the Nixle alerts?
I haven't actually had any conversations about that with anyone, but definitely it's probably worthwhile exploring. We do communicate anytime we issue a special product that's sort of in addition to an avalanche forecast, such as an avalanche watch, avalanche warning. We communicate that information through the National Weather Service, and so they can put that up on NOAA's website. And I do know that depending on if you're in Montana or Idaho, their forecast offices notify special products on a slightly different geographic platform. In Idaho here, it's based off counties, and in Montana, they use what's called forecast zones. And so that's another avenue to get supplemental information about special products. Now, our regular avalanche forecasts don't get ping through that same communication platform on a regular basis.
Now, I know it's early in the season, and this is the affiliated friends group usually putting on outreach events and the avalanche awareness training classes. But are there any events or upcoming activities like that that you'd like to talk about or announce?
Yeah, so within the last week, our friends group got all of our education opportunities classes for this upcoming season live on the website, and you can go there and register if there's anything you're interested in. Same website, idahopanhandleavalanche.org/education, I believe. But yeah, here at the end of October, our avalanche awareness tour sort of begins, and those are free intro level talks. They're typically about an hour long that just kind of give you some real basic information about avalanche safety, terrain, things to kind of recognize, and that tour goes on. I don't know the exact dates, but it's kind of all over the board throughout the region. And then in December and January are more structured classes, like our level ones and for motorized or non-motorized, our rescue skills classes. I think they're doing a backcountry 101. I think they're doing a ride, go ride with, IPAC day in the mountains. And so there's a lot of really neat and good opportunities for people to advance their knowledge and education and just good continuing education of avalanche awareness education and traveling in the mountains. And so, yeah, a lot of fantastic opportunities, too many to list here for sure.
Yeah, do check that out. And those are always great offerings. Anyone who lives in the winter, and we all do, much less if they actually get out and recreate in the winter, should have some basic understanding of avalanche dynamics and threats to be able to assess them.
Yep, absolutely. And then one thing we're bringing back this year, which I think was kind of a big hit, a little before COVID or kind of right around that, are the snow, like the snow pit chats or the snowpack chats, which are going to be, I think they're going to be like once, maybe twice a month, starting in December, going through February. And they're going to be kind of more of an informal, but kind of intimate discussion, going to be led by a different person on our forecast team each time, and just really kind of diving more into the current conditions and more of the intricate happenings of the snowpack. So definitely will be a fun topic to pay, look out for and pay attention for, because I think there could be some interesting discussions depending on the time of year that come about it with the public and our forecast staff and current conditions. So,
Those activities are always listed on your website and Facebook page, and we try to highlight those on the morning show when we can. Sometimes we run out of time for current events, but one of the better community calendars is the link on our KRFY.org website to the Sandpoint Online calendar, which almost always includes those activities. So check back there as the season progresses. Before we come to a close, we're kind of winding down. Any additional thoughts, anything I haven't asked that you'd like to share with the audience?
yeah, I would just say I'm, extremely excited to be a part of the community. My family and I have enjoyed the Sandpoint area so far. Everyone is seeming to get into a rhythm finally. And I guess, you know, from an avalanche standpoint, really to build a sustainable, healthy forecast program, it requires strong cooperative relationships with everyone in the community and adjacent towns. And so I encourage folks to stay engaged with the center, come out and support our friends group at their events. And please share us your observations if you're out in the mountains cruising around. It takes a village to raise a family, and we need public observation engagement really to help fit the puzzle pieces together and make our forecast products better. Because without having all the eyes and ears of public in conjunction with what we're seeing, we're making a lot of guessing. So if you're out and about and see something interesting, it doesn't have to be technical. Picture speaks a thousand words. Send us something. It's great to hear from you. So.
We usually ask, and often at the beginning, people who are new to the community, their Long Bridge moment, their Long Bridge story, which seems self-explanatory, but really curious what your impressions were coming across the Long Bridge. And I'm projecting you probably saw snow.
I was sort of like, man, this could be terrifying in a complete whiteout. I've quickly learned that if you're caught on the north side of the bridge, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So, but
That's a good attitude. Well, once again, we want to thank Chris Bilbray for being the new director of the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center for coming on the show this morning. We look forward to having you back. If there's any big developments this winter, feel free to let us know, and we'll sketch out a few moments on one of the upcoming morning shows. But thank you for joining us this morning, Chris.
yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.